This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. She's running after months of speculation and a sneak preview from Boston Mayor Marty Walsh himself last week. Boston City Councilor Michelle Wu announced today that she is running for mayor. The top vote-getter in the Boston City Council at large elections twice, Wu would be the first woman and first person of color to hold the office. It is a busy campaign day for Michelle Wu, but we caught up with her just about an hour ago. She was in her car and started by telling us about the critical issues she sees facing the city.
We are in a moment of crisis. We are facing an ongoing pandemic, an economic crisis, a national reckoning on structural racism and climate change. And so in this moment, Boston has the resources to be a city for everyone, but we really need bold, urgent leadership to meet this moment. And that has to be grounded in community across every neighborhood of the city.
So why do you feel that you are the person who can address these issues? These are big issues that you're talking about in an unprecedented time. Why do you feel you're the person who can address these issues as mayor of Boston?
This is about bringing leadership from every community to the forefront. In my time on the council, I've seen that when you work in coalition, when you follow the lead of community members, the ideas that are put forward can happen at the city level and can be implemented pretty immediately. Everything from ramping up our renewable energy sourcing to groundbreaking legislation when it comes to language access and safety. There's a lot that the city can do, and it depends on having a partnership with community members who are living the realities.
Counselor, how important are your identities and your lived experience? You talk about being a mother, a woman of color, a daughter of an immigrant family. How important is that to your pitch to Boston voters?
Everything that I do is shaped by the experiences that I've had with my family and that I've heard in families all across the city who share the same struggles and dreams. I am a daughter of immigrants, someone who never thought I would be running for office when I was a young girl. And I get my resilience from seeing the challenges that my parents faced as immigrants to this country who came here with nothing. And I'm a mom. I have two boys who are 3 and 5. And so whether it's trying to figure out the school system and how we're going to get through this current crisis in Boston Public Schools reopening, or having to figure out how I'm going to get around the city with a massive stroller with two kids in it, it's impossible to ignore the issues when you're living them.
You say that we are a city in crisis. You talk about the pandemic, the economic crisis that we're in. Mayor Walsh has been widely praised for his handling of the coronavirus pandemic here. Healthcare leaders like Kevin Tabb, the head of Beth Israel Lahey, Kate Walsh, the head of the Boston Medical Center. Especially he's been praised for acting quickly, early in the crisis. The average positive test rate in this city is down below 2%. Do you agree that Mayor Walsh has managed the pandemic well for the city of Boston?
We need to celebrate the way that Boston came together during this crisis to really try to provide resources. And we can't settle for a reality that still reinforces and has deepened deep disparities across our city. The pandemic has only worsened the issues that our families across the city were already facing. And so we need bold, urgent leadership that prioritizes and puts forward a vision that is based on what communities are facing and that we need to take care of, not just for relief and for immediate band-aids, but that long-term systemic change.
You call for bold leadership. What's an example of a time when you've demonstrated boldness in your leadership in your time with the city council?
I'm proud to have stood with so many coalitions in putting forward changes that have reshaped what people believe was possible from city government, whether it was taking on Airbnb or taking on transportation and claiming public transportation as an issue that the city government could actually make a big difference in, pushing for fare free transit and public transportation as a public good.
Let me stop you there. You just mentioned the push for free transit. We know that the MBTA is in financial crisis. We know just this week they talked about potentially the need for reduction in service. Given the likely long-term crisis for the MBTA, will you continue to push for the T to be free, or are we in a different place now?
Absolutely, the T needs to be free. And we need to figure out and rethink our systems of financing and service to get us there. We saw during the pandemic that many of our major institutions took steps to ensure safety and to recognize the incredible economic hardship that people were facing. And the T did that as well. They made buses free during the pandemic. It just shows that the right thing to do for our health and safety was what the right thing to do for economic mobility as well.
This is a time they're facing massive budget shortfalls because of lack of revenue. So yes, they did make the buses free in response to the pandemic, but they are taking serious financial hits. How does that become sustainable?
This is a time when every transit agency across the country has to rethink how we do financing. As ridership has declined, it will become less and less possible to sustain our systems based on a fare-based system where every rider must shoulder the burden. We know that this is the direction we need to move for climate justice in the city, for economic opportunity in the city, and so clearly seen here, the public health and safety of all of our residents. Now, I want to just really highlight the leadership from the federal level on this issue. I've been proud to work with Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, and she has filed a bill with Senator Ed Markey called the Freedom to Move Act, which would infuse agencies with funding for fare-free transportation and increases in service from a lens of equity. So there are resources available. We just need to really prioritize communities that have been most affected and the ways in which we have to invest in the long term.
Councillor Wu, let's go back to the pandemic for a minute. We are still in the pandemic. Is there something you feel the city and or the mayor could or should have done differently in the first few months of the pandemic or should be doing differently now for better public health outcomes or economic outcomes in the moment?
Yeah, the beginning of the pandemic was certainly a difficult, stressful time for everyone in the city. And what we see now, months later, is that even as the city came together, even as resources came together, we still face the very same disparities by race, by income, by neighborhood in Boston today, and in fact have been deepened during the course of the pandemic. You know, I'm a mom. I am my older son is a student in the Boston Public Schools, and we are still living with the uncertainty of what will happen with school reopening, where and when he might be able going into which buildings. This is an issue that has taken a long time for the school district to even start to present plans. You know, we've lost a lot of time in planning ahead. And while the focus and immediate response has been very, very important, we have missed opportunities to plan for the long term and to really connect our recovery with
Me interrupt you there. Excuse me. I'm sorry. It's just we have limited time with you, and I want to make sure to clarify all my questions. Is there something specifically you would have done around when schools closed or how they're reopening now or other parts of the lockdown?
We first got a draft school reopening plan late in the summer. We knew that this was a likelihood that schools would need to be remote in some fashion or another this school year, as early as when we shut down schools in March. And so there should have been some guidance very early on from the public health department, from the school department, and from outside those agencies as well. We would be in a very different place today if there had been conversations starting months ago about what facilities might be available, how to better equip our very old school buildings to handle the air ventilation and airflow issues, and to think creatively about how we might be offering groups of students a safe way to come back to school all at once. Instead, at this point, we're left with some difficult choices because the planning did not happen until far too late into the school year.
Councilor Wu, I want to talk about policing for just a minute. The Police Reform Task Force for the city is recommending a variety of changes to the city's force, including the creation of an independent office with broad investigatory and subpoena powers, expanding the use of body-worn cameras. Mayor Walsh created that task force this summer. He has said he is committed to taking action on those recommendations. Would you do the same, and would you take action on all of them?
The recommendations from the task force are specific, they're actionable, they're impactful. Yes, absolutely, the city should take action on all of them. However, not all of the steps are as simple as passing legislation or allocating funding. So we need to make sure that what is completely within the city's power happens immediately, but that there's also the continued advocacy for the pieces that require state legislation, for the pieces that require collective bargaining that is ongoing now to line up with what has been recommended by the task force. So there are many ways that the administration and the city could be implementing this. And in fact, many of these recommendations echo similar recommendations that have been made in the past. So this is an urgent priority, and the resources and the political will need to be put to making them happen.
Councillor, it is notoriously hard to unseat an incumbent mayor in Boston, especially one with a strong approval rating. The last time it happened was 1949, when John Hines defeated James Michael Curley, and Curley had served federal prison time at that point. We saw a little bit of the power of the incumbency of the mayor when he confirmed to the Boston Globe before you announced your candidacy that you were going to be running for mayor. Why do you think this is the moment when that trend can be reversed and you could potentially, now Mayor Walsh has not said he's running, but that you could potentially unseat a sitting mayor in the city of Boston?
We love our history in Boston. And, you know, the reality as a city that is full of history is we know no one is the first until they do it and it happens. What I like to emphasize is that we're actually building a movement here to connect with the real history of Boston, our legacy as a city that has always stood up for what is right, fighting for those systemic big picture changes, even when the odds are slim. And this is a fight that is going to be a conversation with every community in the city, with every neighborhood of Boston, about how we can take action now with the bold, urgent leadership that our families deserve.
That was Boston City Councilor Michelle Wu, who announced this morning that she's running for mayor. It's been a hard 6 months. Loss of jobs and loved ones, social and physical isolation, figuring out school plans and the uncertainty of how to be at home, confronting racism and our nation's history of racial violence. It's been a lot, mentally and emotionally, and that is showing up in our everyday lives. A recent study from the Boston University School of Public Health found that the number of American adults with depression symptoms has more than tripled during the coronavirus pandemic. And people of color are particularly struggling. Their rates are higher as they are being affected disproportionately by the health and economic toll of the pandemic, while living through systemic racism and our national reckoning on race. So we want to ask you, how are you? How are you holding up with the stress that comes with this pandemic, with the reckoning, with our economic crisis? How are you coping, and what do you need to know about how to cope? Call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. And we have a wonderful group of guests to respond to you and have this conversation. First, we have Dr. Nicole Christian Braithwaite, psychiatrist and CEO of Well Minds Psychiatry and Consulting Company here in Boston, and Senior Vice President and Medical Director for Insight and Regroup Telepsychiatry. Welcome, Dr. Nicole.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Also on the line is Larry Berkowitz, a licensed psychologist in Massachusetts and the director and co-founder of Riverside Trauma Center. Larry, welcome back to the show.
Tiziana, hi. Good to be here.
And we're also pleased to welcome Boston NAACP President Tanisha Sullivan. Tanisha, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I really want to start by asking you each how you are. Tanisha, how are you?
Thank you so much for the question. I am well. I'm well and very fortunate to have today both physical, mental, and spiritual wellness. So thank you for the question.
Absolutely. How about you, Dr. Nicole?
I'm doing okay. I actually have a family member currently in the ICU with COVID, so that's certainly stressful, but beyond that, we're doing okay. Thank you.
Is your family member getting the care that they need?
Yes, I think so. He had to be emergently intubated a few days ago. So with COVID, everything is day to day, moment to moment. It's so hard to know where things will go.
I'm really sorry to hear that. Larry, how about you? How are you?
Thanks for the question. I'd say I'm doing well. I'm fortunate and blessed in many ways to be able to be working and be safe and have the resources to be able to be okay in these times. And yet, like everyone, I'd say I'm a little bit stressed. I'm feeling the loss of connection to my routines and my friends and supports, and everything's new and different for all of us, and that's a little stressful.
And listeners, again, I just really want to invite you into this conversation. Tell us how you are. Tell us what your questions are about mental health and coping. Tell us about your lived experience, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Are we seeing an increase in discussions about mental health, requests to become patients, requests for referrals, et cetera? Dr. Nicole, what are you seeing?
Yeah, certainly. So I think both with adults and children, I see both. I'm seeing people essentially trying to survive two pandemics, the COVID pandemic, which is disproportionately impacting people of color, but then the pandemic of this national discourse on racism, which has been an ongoing issue for people of color, but suddenly is becoming an issue for people who weren't living it every day. And for many people, All of these events, both with the death of many innocent Black people that were being inundated with these videos and these pictures, and the loss of family and friends, people are absolutely overwhelmed. And so many of the calls that I'm getting, not only from adults, but from parents, I've been suddenly receiving numerous calls from college students who just arrived in the city, and they're stressed, they're anxious, they're overwhelmed, they're fearful.
Larry, what are the triggers? What are the stressors that people are experiencing right now that are more intense or new compared to what we might have seen, let's say, 12 months ago?
Well, certainly just the whole uncertainty of the pandemic, the worries, the fear that are out there. And I do think absolutely combined with the racial reckoning that's going on in our communities across the nation, the pandemic, the natural disasters that are happening, I think there's just this huge load on all of us to try to take in and process and understand. For as many of us as feel somewhat safe and are fortunate, there are just as many and even increased numbers of people who, while they understand what the needs are to keep themselves physically safe, have demands to continue to get to work, to care for others. You know, you mentioned some of the studies, the CDC that reported on data from April through June recently that said that 40% of adults reported struggling with mental health challenges or substance use that's new to them, and particularly younger adults, racial, ethnic minorities, essential workers, unpaid adult caregivers. So the stresses are significant and hitting a lot of people.
Tanisha, let's pick up on that last thread of what Larry just said. It's been a time of loss and trauma for the Black community, and very publicly so. Everything from the deaths of leaders like John Lewis, actor Chadwick Boseman, athlete Kobe Bryant, constant videos of police violence against Black men and women. How does that factor into mental health in this moment?
Yeah, no, I think this conversation is so critically important. And about 3-4 years ago, as an organization, the NAACP Boston branch, we really recognized the need for us to open up this conversation even more about mental wellness and mental health, primarily because, you know, as our nation is coming to get a better understanding of really the emotional and mental trauma that Black America has been experiencing for generations. The reality is Black America has been experiencing this trauma for generations. And for much of that time, for many of us, you know, seeking and receiving mental health supports has not been a reality. But what we are seeing, particularly within the last 12 to 18 months, I would say, and even more so over the last 3 months, is a greater awareness about mental wellness, and also an understanding that, you know, living with trauma, living through trauma, coping through trauma alone does not have to be your norm. And in fact, there are supports that are available, and that it is okay to seek them. which quite frankly is a culture shift in and of itself. And so what I have been pleased to see are the number of members within the Black community and other communities of color really using their voice and their power to amplify mental wellness and encouraging people to seek supports and letting folks know that it is okay not to be okay.
All right, let's go to the phones. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Mike, Mike's from Everett. Mike, you are on with our guests. What's on your mind?
Well, actually, something came up as you were talking, but the first thing I was going to say is this is really affecting people very differently. I'm in a pod with four adults, two of whom are not compromised, but yeah, at risk. And other three, their jobs are at home. Now they're at home and they're doing fine, no financial hit at all. Personally, I worked in the convention industry. I'm no work for 6 months. But what I was going to point out was I'm actually very privileged. I have a roof over my head. I'm getting through this okay. I'm still feeling for the first time in my life what some low-grade depression issues, and I feel guilty for feeling like I need help when I look and I hear about people being evicted and people, you know, who have much bigger problems.
Mike, let us take it there, Mike, to give you some response. I'm glad you called. Two, I'm sorry about the job loss and the depressive feelings you're having. And I think there are a lot of people who would say they feel the same way. And I understand the question about guilt. Dr. Nicole, what do you think?
Sure. And I hear that very often, particularly if people who recognize and acknowledge their privilege, they will frequently express having some level of guilt. But it's also important to recognize that your struggle is still completely valid. We are all in this together. We're all struggling together. And of course, there's different levels of severity of each of our individual struggles. And I often tell people, even when thinking about trauma, it is not on us or on you to define what someone else experiences as trauma. What you may experience as being minimal may be incredibly traumatic for someone else. So it's still important to validate every stressful experience you have, because that is still stressful and it's still impacting you. And, you know, one thing that often helps people when we're feeling overwhelmed or stressed is if we can find ways to support other people. And in the midst of struggle, in the midst of having a hard time, if you're able to dedicate time or support others or support friends, that can often decrease some of that guilt.
And Dr. Nicole, I think we need to let you sign off now. Is that correct?
I have a few more minutes.
Okay, we'll keep you as long as we can have you. Thank you. And I do want to pick up another call here. Let's talk with Debbie. Debbie's on the line in Dracut. Debbie, what's on your mind?
Hi, yes. So I'm currently taking care of full-time my in-laws who are 88 to 89. My father-in-law has congestive heart failure. The cardiologist literally said he's actively dying. I go to their house every day. I make sure his weight is good, check all his, everything we have to take care of. He has visiting nursing, he has PT, and he has EMTs coming once a week to check him and everything. So with everything between COVID and all of my stress with them, with COVID, I was getting depressed and having a really hard time sleeping. Now that I take care of both of them, she's got Alzheimer's, by the way, too. So with me taking care of them, I'm getting more stressed. I'm getting really depressed. I'm not sleeping. I'm having constant nightmares. I'm having the time of my life, if you know what I mean. But I just,
yeah,
I don't
I'm
know
sorry,
how to get, make any even easier. You know, I just,
so let's
I'm looking
ask,
basically
Debbie,
for
let's
suggestions.
Ask Larry. Yeah, let's ask Larry Berkowitz that. Larry, suggestions for Debbie. And Debbie, I'm glad you called.
Yeah. Hi, Debbie. Yeah, glad you called too. And man, it's just piling on, isn't it? And I think so many people would say that it feels like one thing on top of another. And of course, and sleep, that's something we're hearing from a lot of people, that disrupted sleep. Would certainly encourage you. Two thoughts come to mind. One is that we have a structure at our place at Riverside Trauma Center we often talk about, which is trying to help people think about finding and maintaining safety,
predictability, and control. Those are the kinds of things that can help us manage in times of high uncertainty like this. So your personal safety, what is that? You know, what are the things that you can predict? What are the rituals, the routines you can predict? Can you predict finding time to connect with others? What are the few things that you can control? Can you build in sometimes to connect with the people that are supportive to you, whether that's your connection to faith or have friends or other family that are healthy? Really trying to find whatever ways we can establish those sense of control in our lives. And I would say to you, please, as we were saying to Mike a few moments ago, reach out. This might be a good time to try to get support. We've been able to set up in collaboration with the state, the FEMA-funded crisis counseling program, which in Massachusetts is called Mass Support. And we'll be glad maybe, Tiziana, you could list some of that info on your website for the Mass Support program.
Yes, we can.
MassSupport.org. This is a program. We've got 50 counselors around the state who were able to take calls and connect with people to offer some support, maybe some problem solving around the sleep issues and things like that. You talk about getting depressed. So many people are feeling some increased symptoms of that. But if it's really getting to the point where it's troublesome, I think to one of Dr. Nicole's points, this could be a good time to try to reach out and connect with a mental health professional. And it's so much easier in many ways to do that now that we can use telehealth.
I'd like to go back to the phones. Thanks for that, Larry. We've got Lewis on the line. Lewis is downtown. Go ahead, Lewis.
Yes, hi. My situation is this. I'm a 73-year-old black man born in North Carolina, went through a lot of that racism and stuff down here, brought up here during the Great Migration, people trying to get away from all of that racism. What I see is we have a problem that is unsolvable because America is never going to accept black people as equals, and that's what we need. I just talked to the producer and told him, we give Israel $3 billion a year so they can have a safe place to live. America did nothing to the Jews. Look what they did to us. And all they give us is welfare, and then we get second-class medical treatment and everything. I think we need
Lewis,
a homeland. Yes, ma'am.
I hear your anger, and I hear the point that you're making. I'm sorry to cut you short, but I do want to make sure we get our guests a time to respond to you. I want to go to Dr. Nicole first and then Tanisha, just because I know Dr. Nicole Christian Brathwaite's going to have to leave us momentarily. Thank you for the call, Lewis. Dr. Nicole.
Sure. I think the anger that Lewis expressed is certainly felt by many African-Americans and many Black Americans that the conversation around reparations and what exactly does that look like, and recognizing that often when we're discussing racism and discrimination, people will often make the statement that slavery was so many years ago and I never owned slaves and my grandparents never owned slaves, but not recognizing that structural and systemic racism persists today. So as he mentioned, we certainly see that in the medical establishment, even in my field of psychiatry. Oftentimes we see that there's improper misdiagnosis of African-Americans or labeling African-American youth as being more aggressive. Or there was recently an article showing that black babies were three times more likely to die if they had white doctors versus black doctors, and the disparities that exist in maternal health care. And so certainly there are very real issues that need to be addressed, and we don't even need to go back to slavery. We can look today. And so to really change racism and impact it, it has to be done on multiple levels. So certainly in leadership, there needs to be a commitment at the highest office. There certainly needs to be structural and systemic changes, institutional changes, and then even on the individual level. I am hopeful. I do believe the change is possible, but it will take time and it will take a much larger commitment.
Tanisha, I want to turn to you, but I'm going to add one more caller voice in and then turn to you. We've got Steve on the line from Cambridge. Steve, go ahead.
Hey, what's going on? So, it's been 100-plus days since my unemployment, and it's still not gone in through. It's been a mess, and I've torched through my savings, and also I'm an Asian American fella. So, you know, renaming this virus as that other thing is not helping out. So that garbage that comes flying out of Mein Fuhrer Trump's exit wound, he calls a mouth, is not helping.
Steve, I can hear your anger too. And that, you know, that this frustration is something that we're hearing from so many of our callers. Tanisha, there's a lot there, and there's a lot from Lewis's call as well. Let me give you a chance to respond here.
There is. And I actually want to go all the way back to Debbie and just affirm what Debbie, if you're still listening, what you are doing with and for your family during this time, and just want to lift you up and hope that that things do get better for you. And, you know, as we heard from both Lewis and Steve, you know, this issue of mental wellness and just whole health wellness, you know, is real. And it's something that I think many of us are coming to have a better understanding about how it's impacting our lives. And so whether we're talking about people of color, Black folks, Latinx folks, AAPI folks, or simply working class people who, you know, as Steve said, you know, have been out of work for, you know, 6 months with no real end in sight, this pain and this trauma is real. And it's particularly harmful for folks who believe in the promise of this country and keep hoping and believing that things can and will get better. And the leadership seems to be lacking, as Steve mentioned, from the top. And so
I'm so sorry to interrupt you. I do want to break in there because I had not fully understood what Steve said. And I just I need to note, he was angry with the president, but we don't certainly endorse the way Steve spoke about President Trump with his comments there. And I just needed to break in and say that. Please
go
ahead.
No problem. But I think, you know, it's important to understand, you know, that we do, you know, aside from certainly accessing the supports and that have been mentioned on this program for mental wellness that are available to folks, it's also important to just as much as possible to try to remain connected to community. And try to, you know, I think one of the things for me that's been particularly helpful is trying to remain connected to people who remain hopeful, even in the midst of all of the chaos that we're all experiencing, from the public health crisis to the economic crisis to the racial reckoning. And it cannot be understated, to Lewis's point, that, you know, this is years for many Black folks with this racial reckoning, and there's pain and trauma in having to see and relive these images day in and day out with very little action happening. But try to stay close.
I'm sorry to interrupt there. We do now need to say goodbye to Dr. Nicole Christian Brathwaite, psychiatrist and CEO of Well Mind Psychiatry and Consulting Company. Thank you, Dr. Nicole.
And thank you so much for having me.
And I do want to pick up one more call while we still have time. We've got Caroline on the line from Mashpee. Caroline, go ahead.
Yes. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Go ahead, Caroline.
Okay. Yes. I was calling because you mentioned, you know, stories about depression. And I have never been depressed in my whole life. I'm a pretty upbeat person. I was a teacher and a science educator for the last 35 years, and this hit me hard, and I'll tell you why. It's because I felt hopeless and I felt worthless. With all this going on in the world, I've always made a difference, and I couldn't find a way to do it. And it became so bad that I had to reach out for help and with a doctor. And then they recommended I reach out to friends. I reached out to a good friend I worked with in teaching, and I said, I need help. I said, I need a project that is going to be meaningful, that can make a difference during this time.
And what was the project, Caroline? What project did you wind up doing?
She ended up recommending that I start doing hands-on video investigations for science for parents who are trying to homeschool their kids remotely.
That's great.
And might not have an understanding or background. And I'm now doing videos that haven't been published yet, but they will be
on
YouTube.
And Caroline, I'm going to take it back from you there. We have limited time left, and I do want to give Larry Berkowitz a chance to respond to you. Thanks for your call. Larry, we've got about a minute left.
Absolutely, Caroline. Thank you for sharing your story. I'm sorry it was tough, and really glad to hear you sharing publicly that you reached out and got some help. You talked. That's the best we can do. You know, all of us in this situation are feeling a little down. Doesn't necessarily mean we're clinically depressed. We're having, you know, some trouble. And when it rises to the level that it's really interfering with our functioning, we have to reach out to our friends, to our faith community, our pastors, our clergy, and to professional help. You described a great instance here where you were connected with somebody else who gave you some social support and a suggestion on how to get engaged in something important, some way of giving to the community. What a wonderful way to be helping yourself and others at the same time.
Well, I'm so glad that we did this to the callers who we weren't able to get to. Thank you for your call. We will do this again. That is Dr. Larry Berkowitz, licensed psychologist in Massachusetts and the director and co-founder of Riverside Trauma Center. Larry, thank you.
Thank you.
And Boston NAACP President Tanisha Sullivan. Tanisha, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
What on earth is it like to be in college right now? As we have explored the start of the year in higher education, we've talked to administrators, professors, parents, a dean. Well, now it's the students' turn. We are joined by three students attending three different universities this year. Deanna Schwartz is a third-year student at Northeastern University, currently living on campus. Deanna, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
We also have Amanda Luckner, a first-year student attending UMass Amherst classes remotely from her parents' home. Amanda, welcome to you, too.
Thank you for having me as well.
And Kateri Giglio, a first-year student living on campus at Suffolk University. Kateri, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
So, Deanna, I want to start with you. You are living in the dorm at Northeastern. What is that like?
Yeah, so it's been an interesting experience. I've actually been here since the end of June. I came for summer housing. I feel really safe and secure in the dorms. They're cleaning everything. We're not allowed to have any visitors, even from within the building. And I really think it's the safest place I could be right now.
You're also a third year. It's got to feel really different from years past. What do you think, you know, our two first year students are missing most and maybe don't even know it yet, Deanna?
Yeah, I mean, it's just the small social interactions. It's not even, you know, parties and sports games. It's the little things like getting together with friends to study, or for me, I go to Shabbat dinners every Friday. It's the little things that really make the college experience and that we're really missing out on right now.
So, Kateri, you're a first-year student. We actually spoke with you just a few months ago about some of the lost rituals and experiences you missed as a high school senior due to the pandemic. Was it hard to decide to go to college and live on campus given these changes this semester?
So it actually was easier than I thought. I've been knowing that I wanted to live on campus for a long time now because I wanted to get the full experience. And although of like this pandemic happening, I feel like I've been getting that experience that I wanted. So it was actually not a hard decision. It was a hard decision financially, but not emotionally.
Why, Kateri?
Well, because, of course, deciding to live on campus and not be a commuter is a lot more expensive than a regular tuition as a commuter student. So I of course, had to go and get a few loans, but I think they were completely worth it, honestly. I think my first year experience wouldn't be the same if I had decided not to live on campus.
So Amanda, obviously we turn to you then. You accepted a slot at UMass Amherst, which means you're not on campus. You're currently attending classes remotely and didn't have another option, as I understand it. What has that experience been like for you?
It's been a little strange for sure, but I've become more comfortable with the fact that I'm at home over the past few weeks because classes started a few weeks ago. It's nice because I feel very safe here. In terms of COVID precautions, like I'm not afraid. I'm not worried about like what my roommate's doing or anything because I don't have a roommate. And like, I know that my family's being very safe. And for me, like my situation, it's very easy to access classes and access the work. And I don't feel like I'm missing out. I feel like I'm missing out on meeting new people, but I'm not missing anyone that I've already met.
Amanda, Yeah, you were cutting out there, Amanda. We're gonna see if we can check your sound real quick, and I will come back to you in a second. Kateri and Deanna, do you guys feel safe most of the time, all of the time? And do you feel like your institutions are doing what they need to do to keep you safe, Deanna?
Yeah, I genuinely do feel safe. I honestly, going into the fall semester, I didn't think I would, but I do. And that's because our numbers are trending really well. Everyone's being tested every 3 days. There's really strict precautions. And as you know, they're really cracking down with punishments for messing up. And I really do feel safe. I think students here are generally doing the right thing. And I think we're going to make it through the semester.
Kateri, are students doing the right thing at Suffolk as well? Are you feeling like students are cooperating with the safety measures and it's an environment you can feel good about that way?
Well, actually, yeah. Of course, there are some people trying to party and trying to break the rules, but I feel like most of the students have done their part to keep everyone safe. We, as in-campus students, get tested every 2 times a week, and we can just set up an appointment and go get tested whenever it fits our schedule. And yeah, we're all wearing masks around the buildings. In class, we're doing high flex, so we have both in-person classes and online. And everyone's just been really respectful about wearing their masks, staying 6 feet apart. So I think everyone's contributing.
Amanda, do we have you back?
I believe so, yeah.
Great. So the question that I wanted to ask you, had you known at the time that you committed to a school, Amanda, that your chosen school, UMass Amherst, would be remote, would you have chosen it anyway, or would you have picked a different option?
I believe I would have chosen it anyway because, I mean, at the time when I was deciding a school, a lot of schools, a few schools were starting to come out as remote, and it was very, like, taboo. But I believed that that COVID wouldn't really get much better by fall. And so just personally, I think I would have attended a school no matter if I knew it was going to be remote or not.
Is there anything that has particularly surprised the three of you about your university experience this year versus what your expectations were?
Yeah, I mean, I'm pleasantly surprised with how high energy campus has been. I really thought, you know, it would kind of be a grim semester, but it really hasn't been. I mean, things have been really high energy. People are really excited to be back. And I think people are really committed to doing the right thing and to getting us through the semester.
Kateri, how about you?
I feel the same way, actually. I just, not even my university, but students in general, we found ways to just be in contact even though of this pandemic. Our college is doing so many welcome activities for freshman year students. We literally, like, every single week we have different activities throughout the day that we can attend either in person or on Zoom. It's our choice. They made that available for us, and I think it's so great because everyone is still, like, meeting each other. There's still really that first year energy of, like, meeting so many new people, although having all this, like, you know, virus and yeah.
And Amanda, is there anything that you think maybe you're able to do well or differently because you are studying from home that maybe you couldn't do if you were on campus?
I think I have a little bit more freedom in terms of my own schedule, because I can literally just, I have full fridge access. Like, I don't have to worry about, oh, when am I getting food? When am I doing this? It's really, I can focus on academics as much as possible, but it's definitely a lot harder to meet people because you're not seeing anyone in person. You're really only seeing people on Zoom. So that's a little bit harder.
You know, we've heard a lot of narrative across the country in the last few weeks being angry with and hard on college students for wanting to go back to campus, for socializing inappropriately once there, for attending parties, et cetera. And we've also seen a lot of debate over, you know, are we asking too much of students and are we not asking enough of administration when it comes to testing and tracking and enforcing and keeping people safe? What is your reaction to that debate and where do you think that balance lies? Deanna?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really tricky question. And I think the debate going on at Northeastern has really brought all this to the forefront and has gotten a lot of people talking about this. I think it's really hard because, you know, you know, there's reasons to stay home. There's reasons to come back to campus. There's reasons to blame the administrators. There's reason to blame the students. I think mostly students want to do the right thing. And I think that like the Northeastern student body really wants to do the right thing. I think the narrative that, you know, 18-year-olds are 18-year-olds, they're going to party no matter what. I don't buy into that. I think students can be just as mature as any adults. And we're seeing that in a school like Northeastern, where right now we're working, we're doing well because people are mostly doing the right thing.
Kateri, what do you think?
Yeah, so I think, as I said, most people are trying like their best, although we do want to party, like it's normal. At the end of the day, it's natural, the wanting to meet people, wanting to do all these things that you expected to do your freshman year of college. And there are people that are trying to break the rules as well and have parties or have gatherings, but they're being punished. So I feel like most people have at least learned, at least here at Suffolk, most students have learned that they cannot break the rules because there will be consequences. We're not just dealing with like not being able to party. It's a whole like pandemic going on. So it's not just being able to party, it's putting your life at risk, basically.
Amanda, do you think there's any chance that you'll be invited to come to campus at some point this year? And if you are invited, will you go?
If I'm invited, I think I will definitely go. I think the only way that there could be a chance that I'm invited back before the next fall semester would be if there's a vaccine, like within the next few months. And I think the chances of that are pretty slim. And so I don't think I'm going to be going back before next fall, but I hope that we do go back.
And I want to ask each of you, and Amanda, since I just talked to you, I'll just stay with you for a minute. What would you want listeners to walk away from this conversation knowing or thinking about this college year? We'll have Amanda go and then Deanna, I'll have you jump in. Amanda, go ahead.
Okay. I think that although this year is really different, students are still equally as motivated, if not more motivated, to really like succeed, because they understand that the current environment is really hard to succeed in and a lot of changes need to be made in the world. And so just because the academic environment is a little bit hard to succeed in, that doesn't mean that students don't still want to succeed.
And Deanna and Kateri, I have just a few seconds for each of you. Deanna, briefly.
Yeah, I think the most important thing to remember is that college students, it's a really hard time right now, and people should be going easy on us and realizing that this is a really hard time for many people in many ways.
And Kateri, what's your message to listeners?
I believe it's important to remember that as first year college students, we are the future, basically. So I know that we make mistakes and we do stupid things, but at the end of the day, we're motivated and we want to get this done and we want to be your future. So
So I want to say thanks to the three of you right now, if you'll allow me. Thanks to the three of you for being on today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Kateri Giglio of Suffolk University, Amanda Luckner of UMass Amherst, and Deanna Schwartz of Northeastern University. And that's our show for today. I'm Tiziana Deering. You've been listening to Radio Boston. Stay tuned again for tomorrow.